In 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Art of Move podcast with myself, Anthony Manuel, my good friend, Dr. William Raybar. We're out here in the Canadian Rockies trying to find the grand unified theory of human movement, biomechanics, functional fitness, and what it means to live, be, and exist in the human body. Today, we are going to do a follow-up episode to our previous episode where we're covering fundamental definitions within the fitness industry. Last episode, I believe we covered the term strength, stability, and what else did we do? There was another one that we did.
Ooh. I can't even remember. Strength, stability. Yeah, we'll have to look back at that.
Either way. Strength was the main discussion that we ended up having. I think the first entire hour, 45 minutes to an hour, we just defined strength, and we could have gone on. In fact, I got some interesting messages saying, hey, there were other aspects of strength that you could have defined. And it's like, yeah, of course we could have. It's like we could do an entire podcast series on just what strength is, both physiologically, philosophically, et cetera. But today we're going to be covering a few different topics. One of the ones that I wanted to talk about was flexibility, often bundled in with the idea of mobility, flexibility in terms of, you know, what does it actually mean for athletic application, for biomechanics, for the context that people generally use it in. The way that we kind of approached it last time was, how does the industry use the term? How do we see it used, industry-wide? How does the public kind of look at these terms? And then how are we defining it in our own context of conversation? So when you hear us use these terms, we don't want anyone to be confused. We want it to be on record what we mean generally. And if we mean something else by it, we'll usually clarify anyway. But having clear definitions of some of the fundamental terminology of fitness is very important. So today I wanted to kind of dive into flexibility first as kind of our entry point into this. To you, how do you define how do you see people defining flexibility in the industry?
I'm glad you said that, because I was going to say that it's very different. I think the public and the mainstream just means passive range of motion of your joint, right? So if you see a yogi, they're flexible. Right? Like it's more of like a passive range of motion versus mobility, which I see as more active range of motion, if I could sum it up. Right. But let's have a conversation and dig deep into what these actually mean. Right. Because, I think the cure for people's pain in general is I need to be more flexible. Like if you're inflexible, I'm in pain. Of course I need more flexibility. Like this is what I see all the time. Right. Like, I'm doing yoga with my strength training. How come I'm still in pain?
Right.
And so, it's just like, definitely that's the cure. I just don't have enough flexibility.
Right. So people are thinking that they don't have enough range through their joints, and that is fundamentally why they are in pain. And that's why they have limitations sort of idea. And the idea is that more range is better. Is there like a point of diminishing returns that you think the public generally has, or like what, Because you get that a lot, right? People come in to your chiropractic clinic and say, I need to stretch more. I need to get more flexible. And so what's their perception of like an adequate amount of flexibility as it pertains to their body? What do you think the perception is?
I think it's usually, I don't think that there's the thought there of how much, right? I think it's, I'm lacking it. I've seen somebody online show flexibility and they're looking great and they don't seem to be in pain, then I need more flexibility, right? So usually it's a basic stretching protocol. I hesitate to say protocol because most people just like, hey, I'm going to do this basic 15-minute stretch routine to get more flexible, right? And some people will go as far as to go to yoga and that'll increase flexibility, passive range of motion of the joint. But, you know, I think FRC, like functional range conditioning, really like was the first, I'm not going to say the first ones, but they popularized it in like the therapy world where it's like, do you really need flexibility or do you need mobility, which is your active range of motion, active flexibility? Can you control yourself in this flexibility? And that was kind of like the next level cure. When I like, even I think Kelly Starrett kind of goes up with this, right? Like active flexibility equals mobility. So if you can control your range of motion in your joints, then that is the ultimate.
Well, it's interesting because I like active I think there are so many different types of flexibility that you could define. There's active, passive, dynamic. There is active dynamic. There is, you know, when you're talking about the FRC style of controlling active range, that could be different than, say, someone who is activating their musculature and supporting their body weight in the splits, for example, versus when you're lifting up your leg straight ahead of you. That is a different type of active flexibility, right? Where we also kind of have to define like what limits and inhibits range of motion through a joint. There are actual there's actual tissue limitations. There are factors of neurological inhibition that take place. Like your system will literally stop you from accessing certain ranges because you are too weak to support your tissues in that position, or your nervous system thinks you're too weak to support yourself in those positions, so it stops you from going there. There are all kinds of different things that we have to consider when it comes to what actually inhibits range of motion through a joint. So what's your understanding of that?
Ooh, there's a lot there. So there is the act of being in flexibility. Okay. So I think that's what you were talking about first, which is, I'm going to regroup and just say that, yes, I agree with everything that you said there. Right. And, you're talking about the mechanical aspect of it where your tissue is just too short because you've chronically not been in that range of motion. And therefore you need to over time build tissue to get to that range of motion. And that requires kind of like strength training. And a lot of the flexibility guys are going like, it is strength. You're just weak in a certain position, right? Mm-hmm. Are you weak neurologically or are you weak mechanically? Right. So, yeah, I think you were spot on there. And like, I'm going to come back to this idea because I kind of had the idea that there is the act of being flexible and then there's the act of being able to control your range of motion outside of the context of working on your flexibility. Mm. Yeah, I'll come back to that thought.
So an example could be a person who is training their splits and they can hold the splits. And even if they're in an active range in their splits, can they take that range and kick over their head? Can they use that? Can they control their leg and lift their leg straight up? And can they do an active split by, engaging the agonist muscle of the antagonist that is being put into the stretched position? That is kind of how I'm visualizing it. Now, I did Lucas Aaron's range of strength certification 3 years ago now.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of education on flexibility in the he didn't want to necessarily at the time differentiate between flexibility and mobility, because that's generally the idea, is that mobility is like, oh, flexibility is this passive thing, but mobility is your strength in an end range, right? And that he didn't want to kind of differentiate between those two, because that just generalizes flexibility into the one category of passive flexibility, where a person is just, you know, so relaxed in those positions that they can sink into it without any resistance, either from tissue or from neurological inhibition. And that's not necessarily, that wasn't how he approached flexibility training. It's not how I approach flexibility training. And it's not, it's too generalized of a definition of what flexibility can mean, you know? Flexibility in terms of like access to range of motion in a joint. Well, this is interesting, because in what context are you accessing that range of motion? In what biomechanical action are you engaging to access that range? I think that is a really important question to ask when you're talking about flexibility.
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head there, right? Like, again, it comes back to context. A couple different points. One would be there's open chain and closed chain. I think you mentioned that earlier, where, you know, having your feet grounded or having your hands grounded and working against resistance versus working freehand, right? Like, do they complement each other? Are you actually like, let's say ATG, long and strong, right? You want to be flexible and you want to be strong in that flexible range of motion. Now, does this transfer over to movement? I'm always like, does it transfer over to movement? And I think it transfers over to a certain degree, right? And it definitely transfers over to specialties like kicking. If I want to kick high, I have to have that flexibility, like no matter what, right? Mm-hmm. So it does transfer there. But how much flexibility do you actually need to live in your daily life pain-free and still be athletic, which we have to define as well, right?
Right, we should define athletic.
Exactly, right? So I don't think you need as much as kind of what the industry leads on. I'm definitely not a flexible person, but what I do have is the ability to get out of positions that I'm in, let's say, and get in trouble with, right? So let's say skiing, your legs are free and they split apart sometimes. I don't have flexible adductors whatsoever, right? Especially compared to people who could do the splits and whatnot. But I always get out of that trouble when that happens, or almost always, you know, 99% of the time, right? There's always going to be some sort of mistake because you're going fast, right? But I have the ability, my brain knows what to do at that point. So I always give the analogy, it's like when you're moving, let's say you're an ATG guy, right? And you're like long and strong. Okay. When I'm moving, does your joint, let's say your ATG split squat, right? When you're running and you slip out, do you go into an ATG split squat and just hold and look at the camera like, hi, you know what I mean? Or like, I'm in an ATG split squat, right? Or does your body reorient itself and get into a better position automatically? That's what I want in movement, right? So how much flexibility do you actually need is the real question, right?
Well, and need for what, right? And that's like, because you and I generally come from the first principle of allowing for pain-free function of the human body as it relates to gait mechanics and living as a human being with the basic demands of living as a human being, having a certain level of adaptability to novel challenges that might arise, and to be able to take on a different variety of challenging tasks that your environment might pose. For example, you and I went hiking on my birthday last year. And there was a point where I slipped and I went into that deep knee bend position for us just for a split second, but that's how I caught myself. And it's like, oh, you know, if I didn't have the resilience in that range of motion, who knows what, like, I could have busted myself up pretty hard, you know? And so I was, but I didn't stay in that position. I didn't have to do reps in that position. And I hadn't done ATG split squats in probably about 3 years. So, or 2 or 3 years. And so, you know, how much flexibility do you need? Well, how much flexibility do you need for what? You know, I have friends who are MMA fighters, who are pole dancers, who are expressing flexibility in an artistic or athletic way. Dynamic flexibility is different than, you know, the flexibility, like a Brazilian jiu-jitsu fighter, for example, would want to be able to articulate their joints and almost be able to put their legs behind their head if they want to get into some of these more complicated triangle choke positions. Yeah. A pole dancer who's doing some expressions of, like, you know, the splits on the pole and are holding their entire body weight up from that position would want to have an inordinate amount of strength and to be able to articulate not only passively, actively, and dynamically. But a kickboxer doesn't need to necessarily be able to do the splits if he can dynamically express a kick, because a dynamic flexibility, when you're kicking and you're using momentum and you're allowing the tissues to stretch and recoil, is different than the expression of flexibility when you're in the splits, either side or front, right? So this, how much flexibility do you need for what? Well, in terms of our first principles, you know, you need enough flexibility to express the ranges of motion that are relevant for gait, probably that allow you to sit comfortably on the floor for extended periods of time in various positions and allow you to reach overhead to grab and grasp things that are over your head. That's probably what I would say.
I'll admit I can't sit crisscross. I never could. I think the angle of my hips doesn't allow it, but I couldn't do it as a kid and I still can't do it now. Right. So, I mean, that would be a problem, right? And it all depends, like, where are you starting from as well? And what's your goal, right? Is it pain-free living? Is it to kick overhead? And what's your starting point now? So, a lot of people think it's tissue length, and it is to a certain degree, but take a look at FRC's principles, which is more joint related, right? Mm-hmm. Where if you can't use your joints like they're naturally designed, then your tissues won't be allowed to move in a large range of motion, which mm-hmm. is pretty much their thought process behind it, right? So I think FRC works really well with a sport like jiu-jitsu because it is very much on the ground and joint control in that way. But does FRC translate into real life movement? They would say yes, because we're just treating a joint like a joint. We're recreating your joint. If you can't move your shoulder in, you know, this range of motion back here, you need to get that range of motion in order for it to be a shoulder again. However, they're missing the reorienting your body around it into when it comes to a movement, right? So they believe that happens automatically, or you learn that separately.
And I think, you know, if you're saying, well, we treat a joint like a joint, it's like, well, how does that joint behave in relationship to the entire system as it pertains to the function that joint is designed to handle, right? Because a joint is actually a part of an entire system that's meant to handle particular tasks. So, you know, the other factor that's kind of interesting is like when you're talking about flexibility, most people can put their leg up on a table, right? Off on the side. Like you can lift your leg straight up and like rest it on a table.
Yeah.
And you do that with both legs with the other leg on the ground. But as soon as you try to take both of those legs and pop them out into a split, well, then you have a different like set of inhibitions that your body is trying to like hold you back from. Right. And so mm-hmm. it's like sometimes your passive range of a particular joint does not translate to other expressions of movement, flexibility, range, or just that flexibility or range.
Yeah. Like most of the tests therapists are taught are passive table tests, right? So what is this passive range? And then you get the person to activate and that's your active range of motion, right? But again, it's missing the orientation of the joints, which can only be seen really in movement, right? Like, and you hit the nail on the head. It's about systems. It's about systems working together, which doesn't only include mechanical systems. You have to take the neurology into account there. You have to take the tissue the mechanics into account there. You have to take the joint into account. And you have to take all the systems into account. It's not as simple as just what's your passive range of motion? What's your passive flexibility? It doesn't show that much. I've seen yogis who are insanely flexible and look stiff in motion. So it doesn't always translate. Like the two are not the same, but they have relations. Like if I high kicked right now, it wouldn't look good. Okay. Right. Cause I can't kick above my head. Now, do I need to do that ever? I could probably do it actually with some compensation, right? Like I'll jump first, get momentum. I could do it. But do I need to do it? Probably not. Right. Like,
right.
That's a specialty maneuver to me.
Mm.
And, if I want to do it, I'll have to train very specifically. I would probably use like a range of what's the guy's called? Lucas Aaron's program something along those lines to gain strength in flexibility, which raises another point. I don't know, if you wanted to get into this, but the thought process in the industry right now is if you gain mobility and you have strength, that's kind of the ultimate. That's the ultimate like template for an athlete. Like imagine an athlete that just had the range of motion, all the ranges of motion available, like Lucas Aaron, and strength. Then they can go into their sport and be like excel in their sport. So all like somebody who has those attributes, the range of motion and the strength, all they're missing is a sport and they would be good to go. They would be bulletproof. But is that the case? I don't know.
When I was doing Lucas's program, I got to a point where I could do like a pancake split where my legs were spread out and I could put my forehead flat to the ground and then I could get up and I could load up a bar with 385 pounds and squat it for 2 or 3 reps. Now, I never really tested my 1 rep max when I was doing that, but I was probably well over 400 pounds. And I did feel pretty good, but was I still stretching out and feeling like my back would kind of ache if I walked too long? And, you know, yeah, of course. Like I was still achy. I still didn't have the lifetime pain-free sort of experience that I'm having now, where I'm less focused on that type of training. Did I feel better than when I was just weightlifting? 100%. I felt like night and day difference in terms of how good I felt in my body. I could actually kick myself shin to forehead. Like I could make contact. Yeah. Like if I did the high kick, I could literally kick myself in the head, which was funny. I got pretty flexible. Now, what translation does that have to biomechanics? Well, if your body learns to organize itself in particular ways and it has access to all these ranges, but it still doesn't know how to optimally transfer energy in an efficient way, then you haven't learned how to transfer energy in an efficient way, right? So the question that kind of comes up, you know, one of the criticisms about training flexibility through stretching, whether passive stretching, active stretching, training these extreme ranges of motion that comes up in the functional fitness industry is that it can lengthen tissues in a way that makes you flaccid, that makes you not have tensegrity or the intent, you know, like the even distribution of length and or compression and tension that naturally keeps your body buoyant and supported without effort, right? And it's an interesting criticism because you know, a lot of other guys would say, well, if you're training flexibility in a context of strength, in terms of like creating strength through that length, then that wouldn't necessarily be an issue. Of course, I think the functional fitness crowd would probably say, well, if you're lengthening ligaments and these other connective tissues that aren't meant to be lengthened to these ranges, then you're kind of screwing yourself because it's not necessarily muscle tension. In the long run, you're going to have these overly lengthened fascial networks, these overly lengthened connective tissues that will not be able to support you as you get older. What's your kind of take on that?
Yeah, like I like the tensegrity model. Okay. Like how to get there there's a whole bunch of theories on how to get there, right? But you raised a good point. Like, how do I say this? Like, is the FRC approach, which doesn't really take muscle length into account, okay, and doesn't really mess with tensegrity so much, okay, it has the joint approach, is that doesn't take a tensegrity into account in that way. It's not overstretching muscles like yoga, let's say, or it's not, you know, overstretching like a range of strength type maneuvering. It's only taking joint capsules into account and recreating the joint. Okay. So maybe this doesn't have much to do with what you're saying, but is what I see from the FRC practitioners basically is they do just keep doing it and you get really good at FRC. And I see this with a lot of different systems. Is you get really good at the systems, but can you move it out of the system and recreate better movement outside of the systems?
Right.
So I don't see that a lot. I don't see good movement outside of the systems, even like PRI. I'm gonna name names, right? PRI. I see a lot of like theoretical, if I do this maneuver and this is relative to this motion, then this is internally rotating as that's externally rotating. So this is happening because of it. And it's like, okay, maybe theoretically, but can you translate, can you show me the result of that in real movement, life motion? And I don't see that very much. Right. So do these exercises actually translate into real life motion? Are you actually able to express your full potential in a movement from these systems? I don't see it too much outside of most systems. So,
right. Yeah. And that being said, it's like, again, you're kind of asking for what, like I've seen guys who are kind of disciples of Lucas Aaron who end up being exceptionally good at expressing high kicks, really, really good at, you know, like using these flexibility gains that they're doing. Now, some of them are just doing like splits and squats. And that's like, you know, he literally has a program called splits and squats or squats and splits. And that's all it promises to do. It doesn't promise you better move. Like a lot of these things don't promise you better movement. They don't promise you less pain. They just say, hey, you'll be able to do this thing. And even Lucas has this this definition that is, it's a feat of flexibility, the same way that a feat of strength could be performed. A guy deadlifting 700 pounds is a feat of strength. A dude doing the splits between two chairs is a feat of flexibility. It's an expression of an ability. And so what do these expressions of ability translate to in movement? That is an interesting question. How much more specific to the function do you want to get? Greg Lehman, you know Greg Lehman?
I do.
Greg Lehman had an interesting response to the idea that you shouldn't stretch, that you shouldn't stretch because it creates instability and decreases needed stiffness.
Let's hear it.
I'm gonna pull it up. There's a whole post.
Sure. I wanted to emphasize, just as you're doing that, that the definition of what an athlete should be, or a good template, is to have the range of motion and the strength. That's what I see from the industry as being the thing to get you to the athleticism. You have this template of strength and mobility, right? And then you can move it into your sport. What if you don't have a sport like 99% of people? What happens then, right?
Well, like, and I want to come back to that, because I think another thing that you could do is just add in, if you have strength, mobility, and good mechanics, then you're probably better off than 99.9% of people. The question is how are you defining good mechanics, and good mechanics for what? The idea of like your sport requiring certain mechanical expressions, you know, like our friend Steph came out and he's a high jumper. He has different mechanical requirements than someone who's playing football or someone who's playing hockey, right? Mm-hmm. So that we should circle back in terms of athleticism and sport expression in a second, but I kind of want to dig into this. Can you see this post by Greg Lehman here?
Yes, I can. What part were you emphasizing?
So there? so he was talking a little bit about, you know, stop stretching your neck, shoulder tendon, because it will create instability and decrease needed stiffness. And this is like, this isn't just an argument that you hear in about the neck, shoulder tendon, but he had some interesting perspectives, right? Mm-hmm. Stretching does not decrease connective tissue stiffness in the long term. It increases mobility, but does not change stiffness or stability, according to the research that he's talking about. Stretching is tensile load, the same load that strength training imparts to connective tissue to catalyze tissue resiliency and increased stiffness. So why would you expect the same input to lead to a different output? So it's faulty reasoning. Stretching will make you less stiff in the short term, but don't confuse short-term changes for what happens in the long term. If you did that, you'd have to conclude that strength training makes you weaker in the long term because you produce less force at the end of a workout. So much of our biomechanical advice is wrong, not because of, quote, pain science, but because of a deeper understanding of biomechanics. He's arguing it's time to be movement optimists. And then he lists a bunch of different studies to do deeper reading. So he's basically saying warnings about stretching are not supported. You know, advising people not to stretch because it will create instability and decrease connective tissue stiffness is a wholly unsupported statement that belongs in Reader's Digest, not best practice advice. We consistently see that stretching does not change tendon or ligamentous stiffness, and its impact on muscle stiffness is rather small. Any thoughts on that?
This is a brilliant post. Not that I agree with it, but it's a great way to segue. First off, does he use the tensegrity model? Probably not. I'd have to take a look at each of these papers and see what the papers actually present in order to rebut. But even when he says it will create instability and decrease connective tissue stiffness. Does he have stability in the model of the mainstream? He's talking about mainstream instability.
So stretching, which is not what I use, connective tissue stiffness in the long term. It increases mobility, but does not change stiffness or stability.
Yes. I don't know if I agree with that. It depends how the stretching is done. So I'd have to take a look at the papers, which he's presenting, and go with that. Can we go for the slide by slide here and just talk about it?
Mm-hmm.
Want to go to the first one just to actually get into it, right?
Yep.
So the first one is stop stretching your neck, shoulder, tendon, whatever that is, because it will create instability and decrease needed stiffness. Okay. So the way that the stability model is right now, like we've done so many episodes on this, is a rigid structure, which you co-contract and it holds. That's not what I think stability is, right? Mm. So first off, the language here is different from what I use, right? Or what we use. So is he correct in his own model? Don't forget, he's looking at papers here. This guy is a research-based practitioner, right? Mm-hmm. He has to go with what the research says. Stability is not modeled in a tensegrity way in most papers. They don't even mention it. It's not a thing, right? Mm-hmm. So he's not speaking on that, and he probably won't speak on that because it's unproven or not in the research, right? It is in some research, just not like, you know, the mainstream. It's not there, right? So stop stretching neck, shoulder, tendon, because it will create instability and decreases needed stiffness. I don't agree with that. I don't think stiffness is the key in the first place. Mm. So we don't, like, I agree. It won't, because I don't agree with the definition.
Well, yeah, right? I guess stiffness, is it stiffness or length that people are criticizing? Like, stop stretching because it will increase the overall length of your tissue over time, and that will create instability or a lack of the appropriate tension required for overall system tensegrity. I think that's the actual argument, isn't it?
But I don't think he's thinking that. Not in this.
Not
like,
in this context.
Because the mainstream is just like thinking you stretch and you're going to decrease the stiffness. Like, it's literally that simple. They're not thinking tensegrity. They're not thinking what is stability. A stability dynamic that comes, you know, goes from back to the center point and the ability to, you know, snap back into a center point, right? With what we defined last time. He's not thinking any of that. The regular trainer out there is thinking, you know, they did their cert where stretching, I'm going to stretch for 30 seconds this way. That's probably what is found in the research that he's looking at. I'll have to take a look.
Mm.
And that'll decrease the stiffness of the area. Therefore, don't do it, right? So none of this is even applicable with how he looks at it, mm-hmm. in my opinion. Okay. No. Let's see the second one here.
Yeah. So what they don't know is stretching does not decrease connective tissue stiffness in the long term. It increases mobility, but does not change stiffness or stability. And again, you know, stability maybe is defined as stiffness in this context, right? Where, as opposed to where we're talking about stability in a dynamic way, where I say stability is the ability to resist deformation in the face of dynamic forces and the ability to return to its homeostatic center point, right? That's that tensegrity model that's what dynamic stability is to us. I think they end the definition in stability is the ability to resist deformation in the face of any forces, right?
Yeah. Stretching does not decrease connective tissue stiffness in the long term. I would love to see where he got that and what paper he got that in. I'll have to take a look because,
yep.
I mean, if you
list literature, right? So there's some basis to what he's saying, probably.
But if I stretch for a minute and it's not going to bug my connective tissue, but there is something called creep, and I'm pretty sure that is very well known in the soft tissue world. Basically, like if I sit with very hunched back, okay, mm-hmm. and I'm an office worker and I sit there all day, the connective tissue is going to creep into a lengthened position. Okay. So right. I am stretching that connective tissue in that way, but I'm doing it over hours. Mm-hmm. Is the research he's looking at, is it a 30 second stretch? What type of stretch is it? Mm-hmm. I don't know. I can't say, right. Mm-hmm. But I don't agree with this in like, it has to depend on what type of stretch is done, right?
Right.
It increases mobility, but does not change stiffness, stability. That doesn't make sense to me. Like that you can't make your connective tissue decrease stiffness by stretching. That's literally what he's saying here, right?
It increases
like
mobility
in another way,
but does not change stiffness or stability. So again, like the idea of mobility and stability kind of being tied in together. And again, it's like, what kind of stretching are you talking about here? Those are some questions that we'd have to ask. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Let's move on to the next one.
Considering what stretching really is, it is merely tensile load. It's the same load that strength training imparts to connective tissues to catalyze tissue resiliency and increased stiffness. So maybe that's his argument, right? It's like, okay, well, stretching is actually a load that you are imparting on your tissues. And if you're imparting load, tensile load, then you're going to maintain and even improve stiffness.
But what is tension actually? Like, tension is pulling apart, right? Like, it's actual definition. If I have this rubber piece of rubber and I pull it like this, that's a tensile load, right? So if I hold that there, this is going to stretch. If I hold this here for 5 minutes, it's going to stretch. But if I just do that, it's not going to stretch. So both are tensile loads. One is going to deform the tissue. The other one's not. Again, it's context specific. I'd have to see what the actual research says. And a lot of times the papers are pretty slim with what you can take from them, right? I'll have to take a look. Like, he's right. It is a tensile load and you can adapt to tensile loads. That's basically what he's saying there.
And he's saying that if you adapt to tensile loads, you will not have a decrease in tissue stiffness because you're teaching your body to have resiliency in that extended range, in that stretched out range, which will increase tissue resiliency and stiffness in that range.
Unless it's creep.
Right.
So if I, again, if I do this, like, this isn't a living tissue, but if it was, if I just pulled like this, the living tissue would probably connect more. I would get more resilience. If I pulled it and just kept it there, will it increase resistance? Probably not. Like, an extreme example example would be if I tear a ligament. If I went over on my ligament and my leg, that's an extreme tensile load quickly. It repairs, but it still stretches out.
Right.
Take that on a sliding scale and go down. Right. So yes, your tissues do have the ability to adapt most of the time. Do they have the ability to adapt all the time to everything? I don't think so.
No.
So,
well, and the question is, can you hit that sweet spot of increasing tissue length and having even maybe that creep effect, but then training the antagonist and the more contractile element, like maybe the short range. This is the ATG kind of thought, right? Like, train long range and short range, and then you're sort of you're resisting that whole issue of having overly lengthened without strength and short range stuff.
That's a very interesting point. Okay, so get this. On a practical sense, from my experience, let's take the HEG split squat. I go down and, like, you know how you get to the end and it's pulling your Achilles tight, right? Like your foot, I don't know if I can, I probably can't show you, but basically the foot is being pulled tight. So you're pulling that Achilles and making it stretch. But in function, I want it to bounce. I want to train the bounce. So at that stretch state, if I hold that for a long time, I'm going to lose the bounce ability just from deformation of the tissue. And not only deformation, it's more like they know that a viscoelastic property of fascia is that if you pull it like a gummy, the gummy stretches out. But if I just pull it a little bit, it's going to go back to its original state. That's viscoelasticity. Now, in my experience, when I tried to stretch my Achilles out like that, it didn't feel good. I didn't feel bouncy. I was losing bounce and it felt a little bit painful. Right. So there you go. Like, you really have to impart what you want on the fascia in order to remodel it how you want it. And it's not this simple.
Yeah. And I'm really curious because I know you can train multiple energy systems. I know you can train for different movement capacities. I know you can increase strength and range of motion at the same time. Could you, in theory, maintain, like, could you train the limitations of range of motion required to have that bouncy state while also increasing range of motion in other contexts? Like, could you have tensegrity? Could you maintain tensegrity while also being able to do the splits and also being able to do back bridges and some these like contortion yogi expressions of movement?
I think some people could, depending on your tissue quality now, how old you are, where you were in the past. I don't think everybody can.
No.
Definitely not. I think you have to specialize at some point. If you're a 30 something or, you know, late 20s and you like been on the computer your whole life and you want to do it all, probably not. But if you trained from a young age and you've already have those attributes, then you could probably do a lot more. This is theoretical, right? Like, I'm just going with my experience here. My experience says that if I don't train it bouncy and I train it stretchy, I'm going to lose the bounce. That's my experience.
I guess the, you know, I guess the question is, cause like in CrossFit, we've experienced the phenomenon of like, oh, if you, the convention was, if you do too much cardio, you lose your gains and you don't get strong. CrossFit kind of slapped that presumption upside the head. So it's like, could you train multiple functions and multiple expressions simultaneously? Would you want to, first of all, it seems like a lot of work and a lot of planning and a lot of careful, sort of consideration for all the different ways that your body would have to adapt, but could you be bouncy and springy and have good mechanics while also, you know, being able to do the splits and being able to even say back squat? Like, I don't know that you would like our audience probably has no interest in back squatting necessarily. Maybe you do.
Some do. Yeah.
Some do. But, could you do everything? I'm very curious about that. I'm always the type of guy who's like, can I have it all?
Like, it's an interesting question, right? Like, I don't think Greg has a paper for that.
No.
You know what I mean? Like, how do you even study that? It's very, very, well, I don't think that a study exists for that. So I don't think Greg would comment on it. Right.
Right.
So,
right.
Can you do it all? Careful consideration and planning and a lot of time and some good attributes. You could probably have a lot. But have it all, maximizing everything? Probably not, right? Like,
right.
At 40 years old right now, do I want to max out my range of motion and take away from movements and take away from, you know, movement generally has a positive effect on mood. It's meditative, and like I do it outside. Would I want to take that and just start stretching and increase my tensile load? Probably not. I'm not going to get much benefit. And can I take that back into movement? Probably. And the time considerations, I don't want to do it. Right. But if you want to experiment on that, be my guest.
So let's bounce back into this, this post here. He's talking about the faulty reasoning that the idea that stretching will make you less stiff in the short term, but you shouldn't confuse short-term adaptations for long-term adaptations. Because if you did that, then you'd have to conclude that strength training makes you weaker in the long term because you produce less force at the end of a workout. So he's saying that, like, yeah, okay, stretching under tensile load will actually decrease stiffness after you do a stretching session, but that is a symptom of like a short-term adaptation that you are adapting to become more stiff and more stable. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, again, like I agree with what he's saying here. It's just context of how you do it. Time considerations. What is the actual paper he's citing here? I don't know. Can you adapt from tensile load? Again, I think that's the key, right? Can you adapt from tensile load? Absolutely. Does it have tensegrity as a variable? Absolutely not. Does it have a lever system stretching routine as a variable? Probably, right? Do lever systems happen in real life motion? Rarely. So like, I mean, these are all considerations to be looked at when thinking about this.
So yeah, that's the post that I kind of wanted to cover. I think that kind of dug into it enough there. I think
it's pretty interesting stuff. Yeah,
it is interesting stuff. Yeah.
I'm gonna actually take a look at that. The papers.
Go dig into some of the papers. I don't want to dig into the papers right now, but
definitely not. It takes a while.
We can go, we'll do some reconnaissance and see if there's anything worth digging up and talking about in another episode. I just wanted to talk about that, because that was probably the closest direct response to some of the criticisms I've heard in the functional fitness sphere against stretching. And the idea of creep was very, very interesting for me to hear from you. And I am still fascinated by this idea, because like, I can't do the splits anymore. You know, I have trained my way out of it. And I also right now, like there was a time where I could sit in Seiza very, very comfortably for at least a half hour, maybe 40 minutes ish. And because I've started using this walking desk and I almost never rest on the floor anymore, I'm always standing or walking. Once in a while I'll sit down in a chair, but I don't do a lot of floor sitting anymore. So I've lost my, you know, I've lost my ability to do that as well. But, even Lucas Arendt uses flexibility training to regain what he calls groundfulness, the ability to just rest on the ground. comfortably without any inhibition and discomfort. And that requires, in his mind, a certain level of tissue length and, again, lack of neurological inhibition for you to just be able to rest comfortably and sit in the seiza position.
Yeah, that's interesting stuff, because I've been doing a lot more ground resting position, because I do it a lot at work now. Like when I'm working on a patient, I'll rest when I can, right? Mm. And my ability to rest, I look at it like pressure relief. Mm. Do I need to release a little bit of pressure? So I have that sort of pressure valve and seated like seiza and positions, certain positions, certain FRC moves to me are pressure release valves during the day. Mm. So I don't have too much pressure. I can bring it back down to a homeostatic area where I don't feel a lot of pressures on any part of the body. And it's like when you don't have a lot of pressure, let's say you build up pressure in the low back. I see a lot of people actually have this issue as like patients that come in. It's like, you don't even have an issue. You just built up so much pressure, you don't know how to release it. And a lot of times it's like very quick to switch when that's the actual issue, right? Mm-hmm. So when I see that and someone has built up a lot of pressure, they're in pain. And now you're not going to be reflexive. Your body will not allow you to push power out of that and be reflexive. So the pressure was your issue. Now, there's a million ways to go about that. But for me, the easiest low-hanging fruit is just pressure relief throughout the day.
Mm.
The most simple thing I can say for almost anybody, because there's a difference between what's optimal and what someone will do, right? The easiest thing, lay on the floor for 5 minutes, put your feet up, let yourself relax, right? Mm. So if someone has that issue, pressure release valve, FRC is good for this. There's a million different ways to do it, but yeah, I found that an interesting,
you know, I think concept. Flexibility is interesting to me too, because part of it is a neurological skill in terms of allowing your body to access certain ranges and again, express strength. And I'm fascinated by this idea of like, you could have the strength capacity in you to like deadlift 400 pounds without necessarily training to deadlift 400 pounds. And I experienced that recently. I went and I tried some trap bar deadlifts and I was, you know, I managed to like do 6 reps at 375 easily, no pain, no, like nothing. I never train deadlifts. I'm only doing, you know, functional training stuff. I have the functional patterns RG bar for like lower body stuff. I'm sprinting, I'm jumping around, but I barely train my lower body at all. And I have this capacity to just lift this stuff off the ground. And that's in my nervous system, right? Like that's in, you know, I trained the pattern for many years, so I know the mechanics of it and I know how to organize my body in that particular way. But I also think that having the ability to call upon these tasks when you need them, but not necessarily using them all the time and having your tissues adapt to them chronically is an interesting idea, right? So it's like flexibility as something that you call upon. Like for example, when I slipped when we were hiking and I went into that super, super deep knee bend, I'm not doing these ATG split squats, but there's enough trust in my body and enough familiarity with these ranges that I can bounce in and out of that range as I need to. And then I can neurologically allow myself to go there if I need to and stop myself from going there if I don't. Like if I'm sprinting, I don't want excessive rotation, internal or external. As I'm running, I want to have a certain amount of stability in the face of those dynamic forces. I don't want to yield to the rotary forces like I would maybe want to yield in like a split, you know. How, like for me, I'm fascinated by this idea of like, can you call upon it when you need it and inhibit it when you don't? That's something that I'm pretty interested in, because does flexibility, the ability to access these ranges, does it automatically influence your ability to resist other ranges?
Say that again.
Does your, okay, I phrased that poorly. I'm gonna rephrase it.
Sure.
Does your ability to access extreme range of motion in your joints inhibit your ability to have stability when you're trying to resist creating excessive ranges in dynamic movement capabilities? For example, if I'm doing the splits, is that going to really impact my gait mechanics?
Yeah, that's it's hard to say. I think that's a case by case basis, but again, it takes a long time to get to the splits for most people, right? Mm. So you're putting a lot of resources and time and effort into getting the splits. Will it mess with your tensegrity? I absolutely think so for most people. Like it's going to change the tensegrity of walking forward because it's a completely different thing. Your legs are splitting apart versus walking straight forward, right? Mm-hmm. And one is holding and the other one is energy motion. So I would think that yes, that's the case, but I do agree with you that like you should have the ability to kind of do both optimally, right? Like would I want to have, like at this point, would I want to be able to do the splits given no other repercussions? Absolutely. But I just know that like I only have so many resources, I only have so much time. Is that something, is it a goal worthy of achieving for a high kick, which I'll never use other than, you know, shadow boxing or kicking a bag or something like that. Right.
Yeah.
So it's not worth it for me, but like, yeah, I agree. Like, you should have the ability to do both. And I do think one impacts the other most of the time. What do you think?
So I think that when a person is training the splits and they're training flexibility in general, they're not thinking about tensegrity. And I think it's the context of training. What you said about training resources, like for example, if I was doing all my work for, you know, my structural integrity, doing MoveMed and doing functional patterns and doing stuff, but I was also doing like throwing in two or three sessions a week of Lucas Aaron's flexibility training for the front and side splits, would I be able to have both? Would I be able to create adaptations for both? Maybe, you know, like maybe, because I think that, you know, you're neurologically reinforcing gait patterns when you're training for tensegrity. And when you're working on your gait mechanics, you're working that bilateral motion. You're teaching your body to behave in that particular way, and you can reinforce that. And if they're different skills, they should be able to express themselves in different contexts, right? Like does specializing improving throwing impact your gait? I mean, if all you're doing is throwing, then sure it would, you know, of course it would. You're winding up and you're twisting your body and you're throwing, and that has nothing to do with how you run or how you, you know, it maybe has more context than doing the splits because there's rotary motion and there's integration of the entire system, and tensegrity is an important part of that. But if you're overly specializing in throwing, especially if you favor one side, well, of course that's going to affect your gait mechanics. It's going to impact the way that you spiral. It's going to impact a bunch of different things.
Well, let's switch the question. What does tensegrity have to do with the splits? Like, what tensegrity do I need in order to do the splits? What do you think?
Tensegrity meaning an even distribution of compression and tension that allows your, like, it doesn't, right? Like,
yes.
But the question is, can you return to a homeostatic state of tensegrity after you get out of the splits? Right. And that's what I'm saying is, like, can you train it so that's like, okay, I have the range of motion, I have the strength, I have the tissue development, but I also have the tissue development and the neurological patterning and the strength to maintain tensegrity when I get out of the splits and I'm standing up and I'm walking again. Can you do both?
Okay. So the answer to that for me would be most people, no. Some people, yes. Very few people, yes. Does it take resources and time? Yes. If it's a goal of yours, do it. If it's not, then I probably would not do it and look at it like a specialty activity. It's just not a goal, so I would never do it.
Right.
Most people don't have those attributes. Some people are born, like, there is a wide variety of what you see out there. Mm-hmm. Some people are very flexible. Some people have, you know, natural elasticity in their movements, in their connective tissue. Some people are not elastic in their connective tissue, right? There's a wide variety of variation out there. To say that you definitely can or you definitely can't, I wouldn't go that far. But for most people, probably it's not worth it. Time allocation and resource allocation, and it's two different systems working simultaneously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And again, like I'm fascinated by the idea of like, how can you work these two systems in harmony with one another? Like if someone is, you know, invested in a hobby, like it's not a goal for you, right? But like, I do know people who use flexibility as part of their art, And yes. It's like, could they have a practice that improves their tensegrity alongside of that?
Yeah. Like, let's take a, I can't remember the guy's name, Juji Mufu or whatever his name is.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, did mm-hmm. I say that right?
Yeah. Yeah. You did.
Crazy. Okay. So that guy, he expresses, you know, these crazy maneuvers where he's doing these flexibility, the splits on chairs, like very, very flexible type of maneuvers. And he's jacked, right? So that it's an interesting thing to watch. Would I say that he moves well? I don't think that he moves well, but if you ask the Instagram crowd, absolutely he does. But
you know what? You know what's fascinating about him?
Yeah.
He used to be a tricker. So he used to do a lot of acrobatic tricking and a lot of very dynamic gymnastics-oriented cool moves, and that's just not a – he got too jacked. Now it has to be more static flexibility feats. Now it has to be more strength. Now it has to be the, you know, here I'm going to do a deadlift on roller skates and then backflip, right? Linear movements, because he specialized. Mm-hmm. And now he can't do those dynamic tricking movements as much anymore.
He was good at tricking before he got jacked. True.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. And he probably was naturally jacked. Like there's that element to it as well. No, he wasn't.
Oh, no, you see some pictures of Juji, like before he started getting into this, he was a pretty scrawny dude.
Interesting. So like it almost never goes that you become a bodybuilder, that type of physique first, and then you get into feats of movement, right? Mm-hmm. Or feats of, like, I wouldn't even say that's movement. It's more specialty, you know, splits like we're talking about, right? Maybe Lucas Aaron did it. I'm not 100%.
Yeah, he came from a powerlifting background like I did.
Okay, interesting.
And then he got into gymnastics training. So like more like the Chris Sommer's gymnastics body sort of influenced stuff. And so he was a gymnastics guy for a little while. And now he was like, why not just put the two together?
Oh, very interesting. Yeah. Like I wonder, one, how naturally flexible he was.
Mm.
I don't know. And how much gymnastics influence he had there and how naturally jacked he was as well. Mm. Right. Like mm-hmm. I don't know any of those variables. So I can't say. He seems to be doing that sort of thing, right? He's maximizing the strength and range of motion and doing old school strongman maneuvers, I guess you can call them.
Mm-hmm.
Does that translate into movement? Again, the template in the mainstream would say that's the best template. He's got it all. So he's just missing a sport and he'd be bulletproof in the sport because he's got the mobility, he's got the strength. And now all he's missing is a certain specialty sport.
Maybe. I don't know how many people, like, I don't even know that he would believe that necessarily. I think he's pretty honest about the fact that it's like, hey, I'm doing flexibility and I'm doing powerlifting and I can do these weird ranges of, like, he does unconventional lifts, right? So a mm-hmm. lot of rotary stuff and single arm stuff and over the head stuff and side bending stuff. And so there's expressions of strength in multiple planes, and that makes him more resilient, right? So there's an element of like, well, you know, I'm strong and I'm resilient. But in terms of, I don't necessarily think he's saying it's like the ultimate expression of everything ever.
No. Like, oh, man, what I'm trying to say, like, let's take ATG for example, right? Mm-hmm. What is their motto is length with strength. And if you're strong and long in every way possible, then you're bulletproof. Is that, and what am I missing from that?
No, that's basically it.
Yeah. So doesn't Lucas Aaron have all those attributes?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So he'd be the ultimate bulletproof example.
And Lucas was right? Part of ATG for a while. Like back when it was real movement, he was like part of the trio before they had their split, before there was the exodus.
Yeah. So like, I mean, he would be the ultimate bulletproof example. He's got major length in almost everything. He's strong in every plane of motion possible, even the ones that aren't even named, right? Like he's doing these maneuvers that I'm not even sure what they are, right? They're feats of strength in extreme ranges of motion at length. So he's got the ultimate template to me. Like that's what I see from the theory behind it, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I don't know.
In terms of application and movement, we always run into that issue, right? Because again, everything is context dependent. What kind of movement are you talking about? What demands of the movement are required of you? What qualities are, you know, what tissue qualities and what attributes of your body are going to best serve that expression of movement? Active flexibility is going to be better for a pole dancer than for a runner. You know what I mean? Like a runner does not necessarily need to have anything close to the splits. They need to have bouncy Achilles tendons and less body weight. That's about it.
Yeah. Like, no, I agree with that 100%. Maybe we've squeezed the juice out of, flexibility. I think
flexibility. Yeah. Flexibility is good. I think we can put a bow on that. If you guys have any other ideas about what we missed in flexibility, there's all kinds of definitions we didn't cover. I kind of alluded to the idea that there's dynamic flexibility, active, passive variations therein. There's a million and one ways that you could define all the different types of flexibility. But I think the whole thing is like, there's context, right?
Absolutely. And this is more of a conversation. Like, we want long form definitions, not just dictionary definitions, and talk about what the industry sees in it and all that, right? So what do you want to talk about next? Tensegrity maybe, right? Or
I think tensegrity could be a cool one to talk about. I have about a half hour left here that we can dig into, and then we'll
let's do that then, because again, that's missing. Like, even in Greg Lehman's example, I doubt they talk about tensegrity. I actually saw, I believe, don't quote me, but I believe it was Research Flexibility was saying that tensegrity doesn't exist. But then I looked a little bit further and he was talking about cellular tensegrity, right? So the great part about tensegrity is I can watch it happen, right? Like, the model makes way more sense when you visually look at it, and you can slow it down, slow-mo. It's one of those things that you can slow-mo and be like, yeah, that makes more sense than levers, right? It's really tensegrity versus levers. And the industry, I shouldn't even say the industry, that's kind of like therapy, fitness, strength and conditioning, it's lever systems. Okay, lever systems rule. Lever systems rule when you walk into a gym, but tensegrity is nowhere to be found. Like, if I say tensegrity and I walk outside and tell somebody about it, they'll be like, what are you talking about? I don't think I've ever mentioned tensegrity and someone knew what I was talking about. Right. So it's not in the literature, not in a big way anyway. It's in the fascia literature, which is largely ignored, but it's a series of tensions and compressions throughout the body, allowing you to express motions in this isn't the official definition, more gyroscopic way, using elasticity, tension, compression, and the motions become more rotary and more connected than they would be in a lever system, which is what you see dead guy anatomy. Which, it's funny because a lot of people mention dead guy anatomy and then use table tests and be like, that's
so it. That's dead guy anatomy. I want to take a second to like kind of get like a working word based definition of what tensegrity could mean, because maybe some people are like, what the hell is tensegrity? You're talking about I'm not really following. So tensegrity, you could even look at the word. It's tension and integrity. Right? Those are the two, or tensional integrity. Those are the two words that portmanteau together to make up the term. And there's an even distribution of compression and tension that counterbalance one another to create an equilibrium that holds itself up. There's like a buoyant support that is naturally maintained through an even distribution of tension and compression. That's my understanding of tensegrity. And so when you have the I'm pretty sure it was a term coined by Buckminster Fuller, who used it in an architectural context. And so there were, it was an architectural context at first. So when your body exhibits a quality of tensegrity, it means there's a nice even distribution of tension where it needs to be, and other parts of your body are relaxed, and that even distribution of tension and relaxation, or tension and compression in different areas, you could consider your bones maybe almost as compression, and your connective tissue as the tension, you know, the length in your connective tissue and the compression of your bones. That's the tensegrity model. And when you have that even distribution, your body's buoyant. There's no effort required to hold itself up. It bounces naturally and returns to a homeostasis. I've been training that even model of tensegrity in my system for a while. And so, this is my fourth hour walking today, and I don't have any pain in my system. I'm just buoyantly bouncing from side to side, and my system is maintained, and there's this nice even distribution without any, and the reason that this is desirable is a lot of times when people experience back pain or pain in their joints, it's because there's an uneven distribution of this tension and compression, and it outsources into one particular area, the tension or the compression or the weight and the that sort of like makes its way into a particular joint. And that's when you get excessive compression. That's when you start to experience joint pain. So tensegrity is desirable because it naturally keeps the joints in an optimal state of compression, an optimal state of load distribution that doesn't outsource to one particular area of the body and cause pain. So that's my understanding. That's my working definition. It's how I visualize it.
Yeah. No, I liked all that. That was fantastic. That's about what you can say about that. Like, I have a model right here. Right? Mm-hmm. This is the pelvis model. This is actually from Tom Myers, right? Okay. You can see as I move my leg here, everything moves. It's not just one part. It's not just the leg. It's not just a lever. The elastics are modeled as the muscles in the fascia, where the sticks here are modeled as the bones. And if I move one, everything has to move accordingly, right? So it's not just one lever system that's moving, or I should say one lever that's moving. It's a system that's moving together, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, this is just a model, obviously, but it really does work a lot like this. And that's how I vision, when I actually watch movement, that's how I see it now, right? And you could deduce a lot from switching modes in your own head when you're visualizing something, going from what is the lever working. So where most people look at the knee, it's just like a straight back and forth lever, but that's not really how it is. It's a series of tensions and compressions from from your quad and your gastroc and those muscles working both rotary and lever. Right. So the knee may be a bad example. The better example would have been the hip, right? Or the ankle. But, well, it's not a lever.
When you're accounting for tensegrity, you're thinking less in terms of certain body parts and thinking about the entire system. So what does, and this is interesting because this ties into flexibility when we were talking about getting the splits, what does lengthening the tissues of the hamstring and the hip flexors due to the tensions in the lower back, due to the tensions in the core, how much do they have to adapt or change in order to make up for the lack of tension that you create through lengthening tissues? Are you creating different adaptation? And this is where it's like, this is the conversation. How would stretching impact tensegrity? Well, if you're decreasing tension in certain areas or conditioning your nervous system to relax and not hold tension in certain areas, then that tension has to outsource to another part of your body because the whole body is a system distributing load in a particular way, right?
There's a lot of variables here, right? Like, it really goes to show people come at this differently. Like if I ask Jack Cruz, what's the juice here? Be in the sun, light, that'll make your fascia better and then you'll have better tensegrity, right? Nutrition guys, you need to eat like what's it, carnivore guys. Eat collagen, and then you'll need to do that because no matter decrease what you do, if you don't so have the collagen,
tissues aren't inflamed.
So like that's the lens they'll see it. Neuro people will say it's all about the nervous system and being reflexive, where mechanical guys will be like, get your mechanics right and go from there. So it's like, do it all, actually, right? Do it all. I do think that there is a mechanical, like I look at the skeleton more like a blueprint, get that correct. And that's pretty easy to do, right? Like, we're not going to get into that, but there's a, debate on that, but there's also egregious things that you probably wouldn't do. Like, you wouldn't shove your hip way forward, right? Like, nobody's agreeing that that's the way to hold yourself, right? With your hips way forward.
Lead with your pelvis.
Like, yeah, just leaning walk with back. With a lot of muscular tension, having to concentrically contract really hard. Nobody wants that. No. Like, and that's intuitive. Like, nobody wants to have that in their body. So you can agree on that, right? So, but basically there's a lot of variables in play, like I was saying, and maybe you're missing one completely. Like, let's say you're completely off on nutrition, but you're getting the light and you're working on your nervous system and you're working on your mechanics, but it's still not working. You may not have what you need to get the natural elasticity in your tissues. Therefore, you can't get the tensegrity. So there's more variables than you think here.
Yeah. And I think, you know, like I think of tensegrity as a mostly mechanical thing. And obviously, like, biomechanics are more complicated because you need the raw materials to remodel tissue. Mm-hmm. You need the energy, like like we see that I'm wearing the blue light blocking glasses, a new practice, because I did just get into the work of Dr. Jack Cruz. My sleep is so much better. I have more energy. My body feels good. And it's like, oh, wow, this is a factor that I've completely ignored in my entire life that probably held me back in ways that I didn't even realize. However, it's like, I still need, but like my mechanics have gotten so much better over the last few years. I don't have pain in my body because I have oriented my training principally around creating a sense of even distribution of tension and compression to optimize for gait mechanics first and foremost, so that I can walk for hours, that I can be pain-free as I'm standing and sitting. You know, when I work my tensegrity and I work the even distribution of tension and compression, when I think I mentioned this on a previous episode, I had a 16-hour travel day where I flew back from Istanbul all the way back to Canada, and I was sleeping on benches and I was hunched over and I was in all kinds of weird positions, and I got back and I felt fine. Like, I didn't have any pain in my body at all. I didn't have to stretch. I just felt good. My body was able to return to its sense of equilibrium because I had trained that equilibrium over several years, and that's my body's default. And so it's resilient in the face of, you know, shorter term. Like, now if I had to do those travel days every day or every week, even, I'd run into problems. Right. But because it's the exception and not the rule, I'm able to resist those issues that come up because I've trained this default state of a natural equilibrium through tensegrity in my body. Now, I find it interesting because, like, even when I had a more linear lifting approach, I still intuitively understood this concept. For example, someone had lower back pain, and I'm like, your hamstrings might just be tight or weak. Because if your hamstrings are tight, then that's pulling on the tissues of your lower back and it's creating some compression. So let's stretch out your hamstrings. And if your hamstrings stretch out, there will be some release in the tension that your lower back is starting to take on to compensate for that. So there is this intuitive understanding that, like, okay, if you have one part of your body pulling, then it's going to pull on other parts of your body because your body is interconnected. Even if we think in terms of, that was me still looking at the body as a system of parts as opposed to an integrated whole. There's still an intuition that your body is one whole thing and that one part affects other parts of the body, right?
Like Tom Meyer said, there is also lever systems. You know what I mean? Like, there's lever systems and tensegrity. It just depends on, like, your body moves with tensegrity, but you can make it a lever system by lifting. Lifting is very much lever based for the most part, right? The heavier you lift, the more linear you have to get for the most part. Again, and
I would say, like, rather than say your body moves with tensegrity, you could almost just say that your body moves as an interconnected whole. And there's there's no one part of the body that can move independent of every other part of the body being impacted in a particular, well, not every other part. You could just say,
what it's if like, I just did this.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying. It's like, I was literally going to use that example. Yeah. It's like this, but it's like, it's not affecting my scalp, or is it, you know, like,
well, it's funny because I think that if I did this, you could read my, the ECG, on my, or EMG, whatever it is, the electrical conduction on my transverse abdominis, and you'd probably feel some, get some reading, right? I'm not 100% on that, but I'm almost sure that even if you do this, you're going to get some reading in the TA from some electrical studies, right? So the body is interconnected. There is priorities. I mean, we could get into that on what, like, I wouldn't work the tensegrity of my finger over the tensegrity between my ribs and my pelvis. And
what does the tensegrity of your finger even mean? Like, just an even distribution around the cylindrical structure of your digit. Like, for me, tensegrity is a whole system's state of affairs.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point.
You know,
I'm trying to get back to the juice on this one here. An example. It's always good to go back to real life examples, right? Mm. when I was like a jacked bodybuilder, power lifter, whatever you want to say, lifting heavy, jacked, much more heavy, I would go to run and I would feel like when my legs snap back, the tensegrity of my body would increase, meaning that like all the tension I would feel as my leg come back and it would snap back forward. Right. Great to run fast linearly. Right. But it's pulling so hard on my joints as I'm doing that, that there's a cost to it. Right.
So is that tensegrity or is that tissue stiffness and stability that we were talking about or excessive stability?
Well, it's tensegrity as I'm expressing the movement. Like I'm expressing the tensegrity I have at the moment, but it is also what you just said. It is also tissue stiffness, which is a variable of having tensegrity, right? So what I'm saying is now I wouldn't feel those same pulls as I would when I was way more jacked. And therefore I could say that I wouldn't say I feel less connected because I feel more connected now, but it was easier for me to feel that snap back, I guess you can say, but it was too much. It was too much for my body and I could feel that intuitively. Right. So it's just an interesting side note on like the look into tensegrity. Right.
So you could, you could have almost tensegrity in a static state, right? Where you have an even distribution of tension and compression and it holds yourself up and you have a good standing position. But as soon as you start expressing it dynamically, that's when you kind of run into some interesting issues where it's like, how much can you dynamically express that even distribution of forces, or how efficiently can you distribute forces in motion and then return to that homeostatic center point of even compression and tension with tensegrity? That is an interesting concept to me.
Because that is interesting.
A lot of people can work these like stiff static positions, but then not necessarily have the tissue resilience or the viscoelastic qualities that you were alluding to before that allow for the movement and the return back to that homeostatic baseline.
I like what you just said there. That's great, because it's not the same when you're standing still, when you're moving in different contexts. Again, that context specific stuff comes back in everything, right? As far as center point goes, so I like nooks and crannies. You know what I mean? Like I like to be able to come off of movement. For example, in boxing, when you're moving your head, right? This is my new center point now. The center point's no longer where I was. So my center of balance is always where I'm at, or center of tensegrity is always where I'm at in the moment, not necessarily where I was before. And that ties into balance and tensegrity, right? So that one is hard to even talk about because it gets more complicated and it's more in the context of movement, but it does have a lot to do with tensegrity as well.
Well, because again, I think the way that I'm thinking of tensegrity as a state is a state wherein there's an even distribution of load, where there's no load that's being outsourced unnecessarily to one particular part. And that's when you're talking about efficient transfer of energy, it means that there's an even distribution and transference of load. That's dynamic tensegrity, maybe, is where there's like an efficient transfer of energy versus static tensegrity. Well, it's an even distribution of load where nothing is being outsourced unnecessarily to one part, making the structure weaker. You know what I mean? Like,
unless you want it to be into one part. There's times where you want to increase tension and compression in one part versus another.
Contextually.
Contextually, yeah. Like in certain movements, there's definitely times where I want a load way more in one section than another. So I don't know if how that plays into the definition at all, right? Like there's a difference between static and dynamic.
Well, this is the thing. Like I'm thinking about you skiing, for example. You're going to want to drive through your legs when you're doing a hard turn, but then as you release that turn, you almost want the energy to trail through the rest of your body. You don't want to have the tension stay just in your legs the entire time. There's a transfer through the rest of the system. So it's like, yeah, you could concentrate force for a second, but it's how that force transfers through the rest of your system efficiently. That's what I'm kind of getting at. It's like that, like tensegrity is when your system is interconnected enough and knows how to distribute load and transfer it through rather than getting stuck at one part of the chain. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And that kind of really brings the point that tensegrity is dynamic, not static, right? It is very dynamic. There's times when it is static in terms of like if I'm standing still, but I think it should be defined more in a dynamic context, which is what you gave the example to.
Yeah. And I think, you know, like static tensegrity is just even distribution of load. Dynamic tensegrity is the ability to return to that equilibrium. And it's the fact that is your base point where there is efficient transfer of energy and a return to a state of even distribution of load where you're not outsourcing load to one part of the system or one part of the structure, which will make the overall structure weaker because there's too much force in one place.
Very interesting. So there is a dynamic component, and that dynamic component is you could distribute load more in one part, let's say, but eventually it has to redistribute back into a shared load according to the correct biomechanics.
And I almost want to point out too, like as we're having these discussions, like I'm sure we could go look up definitions and we could talk about like the engineering mechanics of tensegrity, but this is the art of move, right? I think we're kind of bored of like specific dictionary definitions where it's excessively logical, and like not to say that there's not a very, very important place for that. And Will and I have done more than our fair share of reading studies and participating in scientific thought and literature and in general, like being very logistically sound. But we're talking about the experiential side and the felt sense and the art of all of this as well. So it's like when we're talking about our own definitions, we're talking about the cross section probably between scientific and maybe literal definitions of these things and our own experiences of these definitions as we're living in the human body. And that's where the art of move comes in.
Well, we're working this out too. Like we're working out the nooks and crannies of the definitions, right? Mm-hmm. And there's not a lot out there on this. There may be the dictionary definition of it, and there may be people talking about what it is, but like in the context of your own movements and like your own practice, not a lot on there. So
I do like taking the time to, rather than outsource our thinking to looking up definitions on Google as well, to hashing some of the stuff out ourselves and to come to our own definitions and then contrast them against other things. It's like, hey, let's take the collective of our knowledge as it is right now. Let's hash it out and form it and compare and contrast and come up with our own mental models. And then let's take our mental models and vet it against other people's mental models. I think that's where I've gotten the most juice in terms of practical application of things. That's where the best stuff has come for me anyway.
100%. There's a lot of smart people listening that will add on and definitely tell us where we went wrong.
Yeah. And please do, guys. If you're watching on YouTube, leave a comment. If you're listening on Spotify, you can go on Instagram and you can message us. You can DM us. I'm anthony.manuel, M-A-N-U-E-L-E on Instagram. Will is at the art of move. And I think that's where we got to wrap it for today. Mm-hmm. We got flexibility and we got tensegrity.
Two definitions. Amazing.
Two definitions in an hour and a half, which is pretty good for us.
Yeah.
I would say, I think we did a pretty decent job. And if you guys have more contributions, we want to hear
Anthony, what we missed out on.
You know, what are the things that you think we'll get back to more definitions next time.
Probably posture, compensation. Somebody wanted semantics. I think we'll get into power. So we have many more definitions to go. This is going to be an ongoing series. If you have any thoughts, any questions, any comments, throw them down in the comments section. Let us know what you thought and have a good one, guys. Oh, Anthony's back.
Yeah, my internet died, unfortunately. So yeah. I'm just saying, guys, if you have contributions, definitely leave them in the comments. And then, yeah, that's it, guys. Go follow us on Instagram. Give us a like and subscribe. Leave us a review on Spotify, iTunes, whatever you're listening on. We appreciate you being part of this community. The best part of this stuff is just having a community discussion and growing and expanding our minds as we keep moving through the world. So
absolutely. Thank
you for listening to The Art of Move, guys. We'll catch you on the next episode.
Have a good one.